at any moment.
All right. Anyway, thank you, Representative Greenlee. We are having a program this morning on Oregon's system of community mental health care and how everything sort of fits in together as a seamless system, although at times it doesn't seem seamless. So we'll have a presentation by three panels who will be invited to come and testify. And so at this point, I'd like to invite the community mental health panel forward with Frank Moore, Mary McBride, and Jim Russell to present. It looks like Bob Nickel and Gina Furman are in the audience, so we appreciate them being here today as a resource. If any questions come up, we may invite you to come participate. Good morning. Welcome. Please proceed.
I'm sorry. Chair Delto, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Frank Moore. I am the Health Services Administrator for Linn County, and I believe I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs to talk to you a little bit about the adult community mental health system at a county level. And first off, let me apologize for the rather crude matrix I put before you. Obviously, my computer skills are somewhat wanting, but last night as I was looking at this, I was trying to figure out the best way and, you know, one page and a few minutes to describe for you the community mental health system. And I think that, you know, luckily for me, many members of the committee have experience within the community mental health system within their careers. And I also had the good fortune to be able to work with Representative Jensen's spouse for over a decade, who I believe brought a well-needed dose of compassion to the community mental health system and her role both as the Umatilla County Mental Health Director and then later as the Superintendent of Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. And I'll try in a fairly short period of time to kind of walk you through this matrix. And please, if it seems unclear or there are questions, please ask. Basically, if you look at this, if you would start on the left side, this talks about, or shows how people would move through the community mental health system, and that in each county in the state of Oregon, and I think it obviously it varies based on the size of the county and the resources available to them, but in each county, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there are crisis services available to people within that county who need mental health services. Most of those services operate obviously during business hours, Monday through Friday, and people access the system either through walking in or calling on the crisis line or calling and just basically making an appointment. Other places that we provide outreach during the day is with emergency rooms within our local hospitals. We provide services in our jails and we offer services to community corrections programs. And in Linn County, and I believe this exists in some of the other larger counties in the state, we also provide services both on-site and on-call to our local homeless shelter. Those same services are available after hours through a crisis response system, which again is staffed 24 hours a day. At that point, basically what we do is we move those people as they access or request services into a triaging system. And as you can see, I've broken it into three different categories. And as part of the triage or assessment, we determine whether or not it's an emergency, whether or not it's urgent, or whether or not it's something we consider to be routine and can wait for some period of time. And what's noted before you are the basically the response criteria once we've made that initial assessment. Obviously, if it's emergent, we respond immediately in person, obviously during the day at the clinic, but we also respond to the emergency room or at our local jail. And if it's urgent, we do the assessment, and then it's within 48 hours. If it's routine, we basically advise the person that should this issue become obviously much more desperate or in need of care, they can access any of those other levels much earlier just by returning or calling us back. At that point, the triage kind of breaks into two options. One is involuntary treatment for those people who have what's termed an axis one or severe mental illness, and is basically an imminent threat to themselves or others. Another way to access that system is if there are family members or close friends who have concerns about somebody. They can also initiate what's called a civil petition, where two people who have first-hand knowledge and a relationship can file a petition with the local community mental health program. And at that point, what's called a commitment investigation or a pre-commitment investigation is undertaken. The aid and assist evaluation is something that generally occurs for persons who are in our local jails or corrections, and it's for somebody who is there's obviously some perception that they may or may not be able to aid and assist in their own defense. That's using Oregon Revised Statutes 161365 and 161370, where the person can either be evaluated by a psychiatrist or psychologist at a local level or more frequently at the forensics unit at the state hospital. And obviously all of you have heard about some of the issues we have with respect to capacity at the state hospital. Following that, one of the options for someone who's been deemed to be guilty except for insanity is that there's the option of moving them to the Psychiatric Security Review Board, which again has the bulk of its clients or patients at the state hospital forensics unit, but there's, I believe, somewhere around 270 to 280 people in the community under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. The bulk of the people that we work with end up in voluntary treatment, and we have and that tends to be graded or graduated between those people who have a mental illness, but it's not so incapacitating that they can't function at least adequately in the community to be supported by the community mental health program, and in some cases by consumer-run organizations or other organizations such as the Mental Health Association. And we work with those people. Those people's interactions with our systems tends to be somewhat more episodic. And in many cases, it can be someone who basically is having a situational crisis in their life that has evolved to the point where depression is impairing their ability to function on a day-to-day basis. Another group of people that we work with are those people who are termed chronically mentally ill or severely and persistently mentally ill. Those tend to be diagnosed with certain schizophrenia and schizotypal personality. Schizotypal disorders, and those are people who require a much more significant level of care in our community, frequently have a history of hospitalization either at a local level on an acute basis, or they have spent some time at the state hospital and at that point require a significant level of support and care when they come back out to the community. And one of the other areas that is I believe something Oregon can be very proud of is the last piece, which talks about consumer-run or consumer-oriented services. I think with the leadership of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services and the mental health organizations around the state, we have been able to help support many consumers, found drop-in centers around the state and within our communities, and they are now providing a significant level of care to people with severe and persistent mental illness. And in fact, we have one in Albany, which is I'm just totally proud of and in awe of what they've been able to do and the support they provide to us as a community mental health program. The rest of what's on this diagram, I'm in terms of treatment options, is looking at levels of acuity or levels of illness, levels of increasing impairment for persons with severe and persistent mental illness. Obviously, there's acute hospitalization, which we partner with our mental health organizations and also contract with on a community mental health program basis for hospitals around the community, such as Salem Hospital or Good Samaritan in Corvallis. And those generally tend to be shorter-term hospitalizations, ranging anywhere from 3 to 4 days to up to 14 days. We can also then, at that point, or during the period of time that the person is in treatment on an inpatient basis, We also have the option of, if we deem that this person is going to require a much more significant level or longer-term level of care, we work with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services and move those persons into extended care. And I think you'll hear a little bit from Katie Anderson later on, who works on the Extended Care Management Unit at the state with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and how that works. A somewhat less frequently used option is outpatient commitment. Obviously, whenever we evaluate these people, particularly when it comes to involuntary treatment, we're looking at the least restrictive level of care that we believe a person can manage in the community. And sometimes we can put a person back out into the community, or the court can put a person back out into the community. And basically with some restrictions, it says this is what you need to do to be able to comply with commitment. And if you're not able to do that with the supports that we offer you, they come back before the judge and we look at a more restrictive level of care.
Chair.
Yeah, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frank, last session I served in the process of assisting in the state's public safety subcommittee on ways and means, and in that process we had a presentation which to me, and it was a presentation several people lined up in front of the committee, and it showed how the state's public safety program worked with somebody that was sentenced into the system, where they were at in the system as they walked through, and they did this with real people. Mm-hmm. I think the one of the people that represented law enforcement was in fact a law officer, a peace officer, and so we went through this. Part of the sanction that the judge, and it was a real judge standing up here, then he sanctioned, I think the fellow's name was Charlie, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name that we gave him as he walked back and forth, and part of the sanction was that the judge gave him was that he was to go back and get himself checked into a community mental health program. It was an addictive behavior, A&D issues, and in that process, when he came to that particular slot in the front row up here, when he walked down from the, you know, after being released and touching base with his probation officers, he walked by, he went to that particular slot, and because the state had underfunded the local mental health programs, there wasn't anybody standing in that slot. And so as he stood there in front of that empty slot, his probation officer came back over to him and said, "Chuck, what are you doing here?" And he said, "I'm looking for that particular mental health service." And he said, "You're not checked in?" And the response was, "No, he was not checked in. There wasn't, there were," and this may have been a county where, unlike Linn County, where the services weren't as available as perhaps they are in your county. Probation officer then took him back over to jail. And then we had a jailer there. And then his case came up, and he went up to the jail, and eventually what happened to Chuck was he got sentenced to 5 years in prison. We took him clear down to the end, and he got a five-year sentence in prison because he kept finding empty slots here that he was supposed to report to. Can you maybe help us? And you mentioned that this is a sanction, and so can you maybe mention how the state budget cuts, how you've been able to resolve those at the local level to assist us through the crisis that we're in the current recession as we try and rebuild these kinds of programs? Are you able to get that done, and how are you helping Chuck at least meet the minimum requirement, and as he works with his probation officer to keep him from filling up our courtrooms down here, and certainly to keep him from eventually, and that's, you know, my heart just sunk when I saw Chuck end up down here with no potential for any, and he hadn't done anything. In the meantime, he hadn't repeated, offended, or anything like that. He just was unable to get the services. Employment was at the table. He was had no employment and couldn't pay restitution and so forth. Can you maybe help me bridge that? I'm still anxious about Chuck, even though it was a fictitious case. He's, you know, it's 2 years later. He's still in jail down here. I need to get him back into our community. Get him to a responsible level in the community. Can you help me with that?
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, yeah, I'd be glad to. I hope this, not much of a seen as being a heretic as part of...
Well, you have to be working mental health. Okay? And then, Frank?
I think that, obviously, when we reduced the Oregon Health Plan standard population in the state, it had a significant impact on a number of people who would have been part of the population that could have been supported or served. Not necessarily when they're in a correctional facility because of the Medicaid laws, but when they leave, there's the potential for that. At the same time, and I think you noted that some of it has to do with the size of the county and the scale of the economy, that and the funds from the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and I think the OMAS, Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, has done a great job over the last few years of being a heightened awareness of this, you know, the issue of persons within the criminal justice system who also have a mental illness. In fact, there's also an effort going on right now called Partners in Crisis, which looks specifically at persons with mental illness within the criminal justice system. That said, I do believe that there is a capacity that changes within on a county-by-county basis. Some of that, I believe, has to do with the relationships that are established between the community and mental health program and the local corrections facility, the sheriff, etc. I think the issue for me is, at least professionally, looking at those relationships and how I work with the jail or the sheriff in the county is looking at, you know, if I don't treat this person now, if I don't provide services to this person, even if it's basically doing a brief assessment and moving a person into group or some other option that kind of from a scale economy allows us to serve more people, I'm going to see them in my crisis system. I'm going to see them in the hospital. And so some of that, I think, has to do with, you know, how at a local level community mental health programs work with their corrections, with their courts, with the jails, or don't.
So, Frank, what you're telling me, that's kind of circuit court by circuit court or county by county, then,
yes,
that they may work or not. And I guess my concern is, when I looked at this incident case, there were, as I say, there were a few unfunded positions, local positions such as yourself that you're talking about in the mental health program. And I recognize that when I look at the big chart of the shared services that counties share with the state, that mental health has several categories under it that counties provide that service. My concern is he's costing us $114 a day down here in prison. If I could divert half of that $114 a day back to the mental health programs that we provide, down where some people say where the rubber hits the road, but in Eastern Oregon we say where the water gets to the end of the row.
Yeah.
So,
Chair Dalton, Representative Butler, I agree. And I, just given the figures that you just mentioned, you know, if we even got it to $50 a day, that's the equivalent of a residential placement in an adult foster home. And if we took the half of the remaining $64 on that kind of a basis, we could provide a significant level of services and supports, and I believe the person would not end up, you know, languishing in a correctional facility. So I do think there are ways to be, again, looking at that. I obviously wouldn't advocate for raiding anybody else's budget to serve mentally ill, but I do think when we take a look at it and kind of the issues and needs of these people, that is a decision that does arise.
Final question, Mr. Chair, in that regard.
Yep.
Frank, and this isn't really a loaded question, although it may sound like it, and if you want, you can tell me afterwards, but I used to have more problems 2 or 3 years ago, or 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, with OMAS and my among my constituent providers than I do today. Have things gotten better? Are they working with you with the issues? Are they giving you fresh ideas? Or is there something that we can do from the local level to help? You know, I hate for my counties, my local providers, when you move from being a partner to a stakeholder to a purveyor, you're on your way out the door, and that's a major concern that I've got. I mean, each whack is a little worse, and I just want to know: are things getting better or worse, or is there a way that you can help us to work within OMAS to make them even better still?
Chair Dalton, Representative Butler, actually, it may be a loaded question. It's a great question for me because I started my career as a volunteer at the state hospital in 1973. I worked for Lane County, actually worked for Sigurd Hospital in Eugene for 7 years. I then worked in Deschutes County for 20 years. Then I had the pleasure of working at the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services for 3 years prior to moving to Linn County in 2003. I've known Bob Nickel and Madeline Olson probably for three quarters of my career. The leadership that I think that they brought to the state when it comes to serving persons with mental illnesses is, I believe, you know, probably at the top of the nation. I think that the relationship that they've established and the partnership that we have with community mental health programs is probably the best it's ever been, I think, given the economic times. And quite frankly, this may sound a little crass, but if there's anybody that can squeeze blood out of a turnip, Madeline Olson can when it comes to looking at a budget. And she has moved those services to a community level.
Thank you.
That's it. I think the rest of my presentation, at least the last in terms of residential care, is fairly self-explanatory. I'd be certainly glad to answer any further questions, but at that point, I know you have a limited amount of time, and I'll let you move on.
Thank you. Questions?
No.
Okay. Thanks, Frank. Mary.
Thank you. Chairman Dalto, honored members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to share today with you some information about child mental health services at Clackamas County. I'm Mary McBride, and I'm the Assistant Director at Clackamas County Mental Health. Clackamas County Mental Health has been working for at least the last 5 years to redesign our children's mental health services. Our goal has been to become a pivotal member of each family's system of care community, with the other serving providing agencies such as child welfare, schools, juvenile justice, physical health care, and the private practice providers. We're moving in that direction. We are not there yet. The majority of our families that we serve live in a culture of poverty. Therefore, care coordination, rather than traditional therapy, becomes a priority therapeutic services. The basic survival of the family is paramount. Our initial focus is making sure that they have adequate food, clothing, shelter, transportation, and the necessary skills and support to keep their family intact. Our service delivery system is built upon the system of care values and principles, such as child and family-driven services. The family needs to have adequate opportunities to tell us and all their providers what they need. We must hear their aspirations and dreams for their families before we can truly assist them. We must be able to hear from them what works and what does not work. This means we need to think about services in a flexible and creative manner. Traditional therapy sessions is only one option. They need to be strength-based services. This means that we assist families as they identify, maintain, and enhance their strengths, gifts, and capacities with the services built around those strengths. They're community-based services. We want to provide services where the child and family are, home, school, doctor's office, as well as at the mental health clinic. Our county is very large, and for many of our families, transportation becomes a very key issue. Coordinated services. It is our goal that the providers are integrated and work from the same page with the family, as compared to the traditional system, which makes the family responsible for the integration and coordination of services, sometimes without much help. A recent worst-case example is the family that was involved in two different parent education groups provided by different agencies, one mandated and one voluntary. Both parents were mandated to attend daily alcohol and drug treatment. They were on food stamps, Section 8 housing, and both attempted to maintain part-time employment. One of the children was also seen frequently by their primary care provider for diabetes. Their description of family life consisted of being with their children on the public bus. Primary care integration is always a goal. We are actively exploring ways to move from just being located with public health to in one in which we are all in the same clinic and provide services as an integrated treatment team. We have child psychiatrists on staff. In that respect, we're lucky. They are a member of the child's mental health team. Our child psychiatrists provide diagnostic and evaluation services in addition to medication management. Medication management is a complex service. For some of our children, our child psychiatrists are, in fact, the prescribers. But many medications are prescribed by the child's primary care provider or pediatrician. The child psychiatrist provides consultation as needed to ensure that there truly is coordinated care around medications. Actually, any and all members of the family's mental health team can and do work with the child's primary care provider or pediatrician. And the process that really ties the dots together is the quality improvement process. We have an advisory committee composed of consumers, family members, and community partners. And they keep us on track at looking at the clinical issues and the systems issues that bolster or impede our progress toward these goals. And actually, this is where we ask the difficult questions and try to answer those questions. I thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There were a series of meetings held during the last session under the auspices of the Committee on Health and Human Services, and I believe into the interim, particularly pushed by then-Representative Jeff Cruz and me, who we invited along, to talk about the integration of services within the Portland metropolitan area. And there was a fair amount of push at that time on getting Clackamas County, Multnomah County, and Washington County together to try and find a way to integrate mental health services. I'm not sure whether you were in those meetings or not. My memory is a little vague. But I was wondering if you know of anything that's been going on in helping to create a seamless, integrated mental health system for the Portland metropolitan area. And we may ask Bob a little later on the extent to which he's been using state money to that end. But there was a lot of pushback from the counties saying, we do it right, whoever it is. Clackamas does it right, or Washington does it right, or Multnomah does it right, and we don't want to be messed with those other people. And besides, there are real different boundaries between Clackamas and Multnomah and Washington and Multnomah County. Can you tell us, is there anything going on, or can you get for the committee information about anything that's been going on to help create an integrated, seamless mental health system?
Chairman Dalto and Representative Greenlee, I think I would rather get you information. I think there are things. I'm not always part of those discussions, but I certainly know that there have been discussions, so I can go back and ask that information gets to you.
Mr. Chair, will Bob be back on today?
Well, he's not part of the agenda, but if you'd like to invite him back.
No, I think it would be better to have that for another time when he's prepared. I don't want to spring anything on them, but it is an issue that's very much on my mind. And as we look at the data that were passed out on Wednesday, there's a ton of services in those three areas, and there's a fair amount of state money that goes into those. And I think before this is going to ever happen, it's going to take significant holding of feet to fires. And I'd like to see if we can generate some of that action during this session.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Greenlee. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was interested in your coverage on community-based services, and I think maybe we all tend to forget it sometimes. One of the major areas where community can be built, and it's been my impression as I've worked with the city and now here in Salem, that the people that really become healthy in a community are the ones that are working with others, that are related to others and doing things for other people. And I can't think of a better place than within the synagogues and churches of our communities, and that's not even mentioned. I think we need to refocus a little bit. When America was laced with active, healthy, growing churches and synagogues, we had people who were pretty healthy Americans. Last 40 or 50 years, we've fallen out of that somehow. And we've all become segregated and individualized and compartmentalized to a degree where you start thinking about your own problems all the time. You're not doing something for somebody else's problems. We tend to get unhealthy, and I see that happening. I may be alone in seeing it. I don't think so, but I think we need to get back to encouraging people into the community centers, into the synagogues and churches, and helping them to get out of themselves And so when we talk about community-based services, I'd really encourage us to be encouraging people to get out and get active with groups of people who really do exude love and care and compassion, especially for children, but also for the poverty-stricken and the families that are hurting so bad.
Thank you, Representative. All right. Well, I guess then we'll invite Jim Russell to present.
Thank you, Chair Dalto, and members of the committee. My name is Jim Russell. I'm the director for the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network. You heard Frank Moore use the phrase mental health organization, and my purpose is to give you some reference information about what a mental health organization is. I appreciate that Sandy is passing out to you now a print of some PowerPoint slides. I'm intending to answer three questions. What are they? Who and where are they? And why were they formed? And if you'll follow along with me, I'll just mention by slide number where I am. I'm already up to slide three. So on the second page, the mental health organizations, and if there's not an obligatory fund here, I'll call them MHOs.
No obligatory fund here.
All right, thank you. They are the organizations that are contract with the state for Oregon Health Plan mental health services. They are, you can see in my sub-bullets, there are nine organizations across the state of Oregon. Eight of them have been organized by the county community mental health programs. The boards of directors are usually the elected county officials, and in some cases include the county mental health directors.
Jim, which is the MHO that isn't a county program?
If you would go to the next page where I have a slide of a map of Oregon, the third one down, family care, is a fully capitated health plan delivering general health services, and they also provide the mental health services for their members in that three-county region you can see by color coding. And so they are not directly responsible to a local mental health authority. There's some similarity in this MHO arrangement to an insurance company. The similarities are that we receive a monthly payment from the state, and then we're responsible for purchasing and arranging whatever mental health services those members in that region need that month. We do that by contracting for these services, almost always with the community mental health program, usually private providers too, providing outpatient services. Certainly the acute hospitals around the state, but especially closer to home, and other facilities that would be helpful in meeting the mental health needs of the Oregon Health Plan members. So on the next slide, slide seven, because I'm sorry, four, because sometimes you hear these MHOs referred to by their acronym. For example, mine, the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network, you'll most often hear described as BCN. So here are the acronyms spelled out on page four, and as I already mentioned, the full page on five, you can see their location around the state. So there are mental health organizations covering the entire state of Oregon. That's not also true for fully capitated health plans. There are parts of the state that are not covered by health managed care organizations. Some thoughts about why they were formed.
Before you get there, yes. Jim, the notation on your map, G-O-B-H-I, that is covering some of those counties on your map that aren't in color, what does that mean?
Actually, there are people that say white isn't a color, but in this case I'm using white as a color.
Fine. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Greater Oregon Behavioral Health.
Okay. Thank you.
That's mine, Mr. Chair.
Yes, and that's why I wanted to know.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to call it out for a special note.
I took that to be the Great Gobi Desert.
Well, it's a pretty big territory, as Representative Butler knows.
We resemble that remark, however, that also includes.
We have it too.
Representative Boone's area.
Okay, all right. Well, thank
brand
you.
New.
I suppose there's no water getting to the end of that road.
Right, thank you. Yes, Mr. Representative Jensen.
Could we proceed before this gets too deep here and we get into trouble?
I thought we were along that track. Thank you for the suggestion, Representative. Mr. Russell, would you proceed, please?
Thank you, Chair. My third point is about why they were formed. As I said, the community mental health programs or the county governments drew together in regional mental health organizations, and in some cases, you can see from the map, there are single county MHOs. And my comments are especially about the regional MHOs in terms of improving access to service. You can see that all counties, you can imagine, I guess, that all counties wouldn't be able to field the full range of services. So working together as a regional organization, they're able to provide whatever type of service their member might need. In addition, operating as a region, there's the opportunity to develop new indicated services. On my slide, I say necessary services. Frank mentioned consumer-run services. That's something that the MHOs around the state, and especially the one here in this region, has invested funds in regionally so that they will be available for consumers throughout the region. The second purpose that I wanted to mention is to manage the administrative cost and the financial risk. Sometimes people ask, well, aren't the MHOs an additional administrative layer that costs money? But in fact, the county governments have come together to form these as an economical way of meeting the administrative tasks of the data reporting to the state and the quality management tasks that are part of the state contract. And also, just like an insurance company, the broader your membership is, the opportunity to spread the financial risk. In the early years for BCN, Tillamook County had an unfair share of hospitalizations. That could have meant robbing their outpatient service, but it didn't need to because they were part of a region. And the third purpose, and very important, as where Mary finished, is the improvement of service quality. A region really is able to work together to develop a formal, effective quality improvement process. Peer pressure enters in a regional organization for great benefit. This region, it's typical of the MHOs in this region to develop new service innovations. You may have heard about BCN of a program called EAST. It's an early psychosis intervention that works with a member and their family and prevents people from acquiring a lifetime disability out of a first episode of psychosis. And the last bullet that I wanted to mention, and a key strategy in improving service quality that you hear for the last two decades broadly identified by businesses, is to listen to the customer. So in the case of the mental health system, we exist because people need mental health services. They are actually profound and I need a word for moving, but connect to your heart about what needs to happen in the service system. And so the MHOs have been active in finding formal and informal ways to bring a very strong voice from consumers and families into their decision-making and into their service design. And I'm grateful that in the next panel you'll be able to hear from some of the consumer and family representatives that are my advisors, and you'll be able to hear their story. So that's about what I wanted to say about MHOs.
Representative Greenlee.
Yes, if I can ask any of the three of you to comment on this. I've been recently getting some concerns from some of my constituents about the worry that peoples of color, elderly people, and physically disabled people aren't getting their full share, full access to mental health services in the communities. And I was wondering if you all have the data systems in existence that allow you to assess the extent to which those groups or other important subgroups are not having equal access to the services as more
I'd like
able groups?
Yes. Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlit, thank you for that question. That is exactly the sort of thing that our Quality Improvement Committee looks at, and we very definitely do have the data, and look at things like we use in a phrase from the insurance company, the word is penetration. And so what is the level of enrollment for a particular group? It could be a language group or ethnic group, or as you say, an age group. And actually the three that you called out have been on our tracking for this purpose. So, okay, we have 6% of our membership is this this particular category of people, and what percentage of the total served corresponds to that? It is. It takes a little bit of sophistication to look into that, because you can't automatically presume that because 40% of your membership are kids, that 40% of the people you're serving should be kids. The mental health needs in the 0 to 3-year-old group are not as high.
May I follow on that? Are you speaking specifically of your MHO, or are you talking about MHOs in general? I mean, would they have ethnicity and disability status and race, perhaps, on the enrollment records as well as on the service records? Well, they don't need to be on the service records if they're in the enrollment records.
Disability status is not part of the electronic enrollment file that we get each month, but the others are.
Excuse is that true of others? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed somewhere the relationship to the state. You're all county organizations or regional organizations made up of counties. Is it just funding that ties you to the state? Are there oversights by the state?
Yes.
Let me tell you why I'm asking. It's my impression that, for instance, in Josephine County, if our county, as a part of JBH or JBH itself, were not to meet the standards of somebody, I assume federal or state, that you could actually step in and take over temporarily and then charge back to the county. I'm not sure if that's still true or it was true, but that's my impression. Is the state an overseer that can, in fact, step in and make sure that mental health services are up to grade? Or what's the relationship of the state?
Chair Dalto, Representative Anderson, I caught a flicker of a nod from Frank, and would appreciate somebody like Frank or Bob answering that question.
Chair Dalto, Representative Anderson, yes, actually the state. And I think one of the things, and actually going back to a question by Representative Butler, one of the things that the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services has focused on for probably the last decade, but even more so within the last probably 4 or 5 years, has been the oversight of community mental health programs and mental health organizations. If you were to take a look at Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, when it came to that oversight 10 years ago, given the 36 counties of the mental health organizations, they aside, and I believe it was a staffing issue, and I also believe it's a leadership issue that showed some of the changes within the office over the last decade, is that they are on a regular schedule. They visit every community mental health program on a 3-year rotation. And any time there are issues that arise at a local level, either by a consumer or a family member or a local official with respect to how that organization is functioning, the office has basically can do an on-site immediate assessment of what's happening. And I think they work very closely with the community mental health program and the leadership, the local mental health authority, being the commissioners in the county on resolving those issues.
And it's a comfortable relationship.
It's actually, I believe, more than comfortable in that the amount of technical assistance that's being offered, given the capacity of the staff at the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services has helped move the quality of care up significantly.
Thanks, Representative Anderson. Any additional comments from the panel? Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate you all being here this morning. Thanks very much. And I'd like to invite the panel of consumer advocates up from the BCN. Well, good morning. Welcome. Glad you could be here today. It's a friendly group, a good group up here, and we're anxious to hear what you have to say. So, if you can introduce yourselves before you speak, just your name, and say what you have to say.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tammy Taylor, and I'm from Salem. I'm the mother of a child with serious mental health disorders. Thank you for allowing me to be here today and share my story. I'm a single mom raising three young children. My oldest, who is 11, has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and Asperger's. On July 24th of 1993, I gave birth to my firstborn child, a beautiful baby boy. Shortly after Spencer was born, I realized that life as a mother was not what I was expecting. He cried almost nonstop, didn't want to be held or even touched, and every small noise seemed to bother him. As time went on, it became apparent that Spencer was different than other kids his age. At two, he would throw fits and slam his face into things until his nose would bleed. He couldn't get to sleep at night. He wouldn't interact with other children. He made odd noises and frequently let out ear-piercing screams. I talked to my friends and my family and his doctor, who all said he was just a strong-willed child and recommended some parenting classes and literature to read. I read everything I could find on challenging children, but still nothing seemed to help. By the age five, the fits of rage were uncontrollable and self-harming. He started hearing voices, imitating things he saw on television, such as opening up the car door while I was driving and trying to jump and roll. He would hide in public places just to get away from people. He would attack other children for no apparent reason. I still remember the day he started kindergarten. He refused to go back because the teacher's aide said, that the custodian would shoot anyone who got crumbs on the carpet. Spencer was hysterical because he truly believed he was going to be shot and killed by Mr. Custodian for making a mess. This is when I realized that Spencer had some serious needs that as a mother I could not meet, and I started looking for help through the mental health services. It took 3 years to find the right meds and therapy to stabilize Spencer. And during that time, he ended up in Crisis Foster Home, Providence Psychiatric Hospital, the Children's Farm Home. But the doctors and the counselors never gave up on him. What finally brought stability to Spencer's life was when I actively began advocating for his needs. I researched childhood disorders. I studied psychotropic medications. I found an excellent therapist who would listen to Spencer and I. And I was also fortunate to have the support and direction from a DD service caseworker who went above and beyond her job description to help me. Today, Spencer is in an emotional growth center at school. His teachers are actively involved with his success and encourage my input so that they can understand what Spencer and my family needs. Currently, Spencer lives at home. He holds a 4.0 at school. He is actively involved in a junior high group at church and is learning to identify and cope with his disorders. Although we still have some rough spots, with the help of the mental health team, I do foresee that Spencer will have a healthy and a safe future. Thank you.
Thanks very much. He's lucky to have somebody who cares so much about him and to learn about how to help him involve people as well. So we appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Chair Dalto and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Linda White, and I am a resident of Salem. I have a severe and persistent mental illness. 8 years ago, in the long, hot summer of 1996, I was a widow of 2 years, living in a retirement home in South Alabama. The death of my husband had triggered a profound depression intensified by my manic depression mental illness. Manic depression is a mood disorder sometimes characterized by extreme highs and lows. News of a serious family illness in Portland rocketed me from immobility in front of the TV set in the lobby to a state of frantic mania. This propelled me on a solitary journey across 8 states to Salem. I left Alabama with my clothes stacked on the back seat of my car and a gallon jug of water and a road atlas of the United States on the passenger seat beside me. I drove as though pursued. On the last leg of my trip, I drove 17 hours from Mojave, California to the Motel 6 in Salem. At some point, fleetingly, the enormous jeopardy of my saga was clear to me in a mind of jumbled yearnings and purpose. I sought help the morning after my arrival at the psychiatric crisis center. Immediately, I was referred to Marion County Mental Health, and from there, referred to the local drop-in center, Friendship House. There, in the days, weeks, and months ahead, I found friends. I found therapy. I found structure, activities and outings, hot, nutritious meals. But most of all, I found friends. Clarity of thought returned. Stability of mood returned. Independent living outside a special home was encouraged, established, and maintained. Old skills were brought forward. New skills were learned. You gave me strength to stand alone again, to face the world out on my own again. I reached out to serve a community that had served me and am now an active consumer advocate. Friendship House was my bridge, my halfway house, my stepping stone. Thank you, Friendship House. Thank you.
Linda, thanks so much. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christina Trevino, and I work for the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network as the Consumer Affairs Specialist. And first, I want to say I'm just amazed at the ladies next to me and their courage and their testimony, and I very much appreciate them. The community mental health system provides services, but more importantly, it provides the support that people need to regain their lives and become full, active, respected members of their community. I'm proud to be a part of that system, and at the BCN, every day I get to work with people who are amazing and have just incredible stories, you know, overcoming enormous obstacles, and they want to give back, and they do. They bring such a message of hope for recovery, and services are needed, and people do get better, and they do give back. The women next to me are my heroes. They're the ones living the challenges, and they're making it. They, we're grateful for what they give us, and we're lucky that they honor us with this, with their story, and they tell it in a way that helps us to make our system better. And I'm just amazed and inspired by them, and I hope that you are too. Thank you.
Representative Greenlake.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I'd just like to make a brief comment on this. I have close personal experience among my very best friends and family with bipolar disorder, borderline personality, schizophrenia, and Asperger's, in a very close-knit circle, and have seen the kind of struggles that both the individual with the illness and their parents and friends and family trying to create a support system around them have. It's really very heartening to end the week on Friday with a couple of success stories of the mental health system, because I'm sure we're going to be hearing one mental health catastrophe catastrophe after another as we go through this session, worrying about the system. And we tend to forget that there are heroes of the system and there are real successes of the system, and that probably the majority of the folks who touch the system manage to function successfully in life with a little bit of help. And it's just, it's really good for us to remember that as we see struggling. And I really appreciate you coming from a consumer advocate point of view to talk about the successes. We'll hear plenty about the failures before we're done, I'm sure.
Christina, what do you think the biggest successes that you've seen in your career?
Well, the type of position that I hold is more, I play more of a support role to consumers who, survivors who come from their experiences in the system or with mental illness, and they want to give back to the system and try to help the system be better. So in that context, the things that I see the most is people are able to describe their experiences, how difficult they were, what made them difficult, what would have helped or could have helped, and contrasting that with what was available maybe. And then they're able to add their two cents, so to speak, and try to help people at the table that work in the system daily to think a little bit more outside of the box, to think a little bit more from the perspective of the customer. And so that's probably the thing that I see the most in my job.
How about the sense of community that you're able to develop with some of the consumers? I know that I've been invited out, we've visited before with groups of families, and it's a pretty special thing when people can come and sort of share their experiences to know that they're not alone. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. I think I'm supposed to be addressing you in some formal way, and I apologize.
No.
part of my response is a professional response, in that it's my job to get to know people and to support them in their advocacy and their role as advocates. But part of my response is also personal. I'm also a consumer, and I've had my share of struggles. I'm inspired every day by the people that I meet, whether it's somebody that comes and wants to be on a committee, or whether it's somebody making a complaint and trying to tell them or tell me what it was like for them or what they want to see fixed. Either way, people are very willing to open up and share what will work, share what's difficult, and the sense of camaraderie that develops from just that sharing. And I'm sure that every one of you has experienced that, talking to someone, you see a person eye to eye, face to face, and you have that connection with them, and you've seen through their eyes what their experience has been. So if that can touch you personally, you can carry that with you into your work, and you can carry that with you throughout the system. And I think these ladies are the most marvelous models of that, and there are 30 other advocates in our system right now, or at least in the part of the organization that I'm involved at. And we always need more, and there are always people learning more from ladies like this who are doing this type of work, coming to the work.
Do you feel like, on a separate note, that there's a sufficient level of cultural competency within these mental health support areas? I know the VCN is very strong, and I'm not sure if you're able to see beyond that, but what are your feelings about that?
In regard to the BCN, I know that those are projects, we call them projects, but obviously it's reaching out to people. But certainly trying to develop people in the system that work in the system, trying to develop the cultural competency that people need to be able to reach out to other communities. If it's a community of color, community of a different culture. There's also, earlier you mentioned, I forget which representative mentioned, an age group, seniors, and there's always efforts that are ongoing throughout the network, the five counties, to increase everyone's skill level in that area and try to improve what we're doing in that area. Anecdotally, I hear success stories, and I hear areas where we could do better. And so I'm not sure that I'm best qualified to say what's happening in each community throughout the five counties. But, you know, I hear both positive and negative, and I don't think anyone would disagree that we do have improvement that we can make in terms of reaching out to the sort of non-traditional client, if you will, or customer.
Well, just one last question. I had visited with somebody that I met at the BCN, that meeting that we were at. She was a Hispanic American, and she was really concerned that some of the Hispanic immigrants to our community weren't as aware as they could be about mental health services and had some kind of cultural struggle to sort of come to terms with their need perhaps for some counseling or assistance in mental health area. And I just wanted to know if you could share any experiences that the BCN is doing to try to do outreach to that community in such a way that's successful, because I think that sort of some at some levels, not just in the Hispanic culture, but, you know, in any culture, really, you have these barriers of folks that don't think they need that services or aren't in place in their lives where they can, you know, ask for those services. So how do you go about sort of breaking through that and trying to touch those lives that need the help?
Well, and these are really impromptu thoughts, so pardon the jumping around a little. The one of the groups that is active at the BCN is called Latino Work Group or Latino Team, and people meet together. They're from the community. They're also service providers within the community. And a lot of the kinds of sharing that goes on, both to staff people or to trainers or from the individuals themselves just to each other, it's sharing how they come across those barriers. Sometimes it's not just a language barrier. Sometimes it's how you view what's happening to you if you're hearing voices. There's sometimes a religious context you have to take into consideration, people's faith. Sometimes there's poverty or economics where folks stand sort of in the community that they live in. And there's a lot of layers, and sometimes if we're not part of that community, we don't understand how those layers are playing out. So that sharing is really valuable. And there's also obviously sharing of resources, who's doing what in the community, so that people understand where other services are available. Those are probably the two key things that stand out to me. I'm probably missing a ton. My boss is probably back there saying, oh, you should say this, this, this. But those are the two things. Those are the two things that really stand out to me. And people really are very concerned about improving access for everyone. That happens to be one group that's going. We could just as easily have four or five other groups.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Christina, for bringing Linda and Tammy over and for sharing this testimony with us publicly. It's not always easy to talk about these kinds of things that are near and dear to your heart either. Christina, in your organization, I'm interested that is the BCN. Its funding is through the state programs that are shared down. Do you work in the programs that affect the lives of folks, the Friendship House that Matt Spencer needs? You feel like the state is a resource in that process? Do they provide the necessary training and the necessary contacts when you have issues, concerns, and problems that you feel like that you can get needs met?
First, I should clarify that I don't work in a mental health program or agency, so I don't provide direct services. My role is at the regional level, and I certainly come across clinicians, supervisors, administrators, and I learn about the system, but I'm not actually providing the direct services. Having said that, though, part of my job is supporting self-help activities and empowerment activities that are brought up from consumers themselves, you know, working on anything from community civic type projects or just training and development for themselves or skill building for themselves. And so folks like at the Friendship House, for example, here in Salem, I get to work with people that talk about their experience with that agency or with that part of the Marion County system, for example, or in Tillamook County, there's a drop-in center called A Place of Our Own. And again, I get to see sort of the results of the work that's done at that level. People are very resilient and very skilled and always eager to learn more. And part of that is as a result of all the support that they get in their treatment.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, to the question of Linda. Linda, you came from a state many states away, and I need to ask, you feel like that even though you may not have called upon them for the service, were the services available in the other states that you may have lived in or around or near?
Chair Adalto and Representative Butler, the services in Alabama where I lived were dismal. They were primitive almost, I would say, rudimentary. All we had was a regional mental health clinic, and that was it. There were no other support services for consumers, and consumers were not involved at all, as to my knowledge, in any kind of input into the system on how it could be improved. You were lucky to get a counselor back there. You were lucky, even in crisis, to see that counselor, you know, once every 2 months. I have maintained contact with my friends in that area, and it remains the same. I found a wealth of opportunity for support services for me out here, and I feel that the mania that propelled me out here was virtually life-saving almost, because I was dying on the vine. I thought I had no life before me except sitting in that retirement home watching TV, and my life has been so enriched. My relationships with my children, my adult children, have been so enriched. And my feeling that I can reclaim some of what I've lost along the way has been enhanced by the help that I have received here.
Mr. Chair, just a final question, and that is, how quickly did you receive the help? You mentioned that you parked in the Motel 6 here in Salem, and I assume that there were probably psychotropic drugs involved. How quickly did you get to the people that you needed to that could give you the help that you needed, Linda?
When I had my revelation the night of my arrival that I was in serious trouble, it finally dawned on me, made the resolution before I went to bed to call the crisis center the next morning. I called them early, like at 7:30 or something, and Mike McFetridge, who was and is the coordinator of that program and also a counselor or screener of that program, agreed to see me immediately. I went to McDonald's and had myself a little breakfast, went over there, and he made sure I took my bag of medicines with me because I'm on five psychiatric medications. And I took that with me. I was running low on some of my meds, and I was getting confused about what to take when. And he helped me. He took them out one by one and set them up, and he helped me get back on schedule with my meds. And at the mental health clinic, Dr. Fredrickson ordered prescriptions that I was running out of. And the same day, I stayed at Motel 6 until I could get an apartment. And and so forth, but I was shored up all along the way from the moment I got to town.
Mr. Chair, do you know how the funding works for the Friendship House? Is it through the BCN?
I don't know the answer to that. Jim, do you know the answer? You'd have to come forward if you're going to
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, yes, both some, I believe, some direct state funding for the contract between the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services and the Marion County, as well as Oregon Health Plan funds coming through the BCN.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Representative Anderson.
That really touched on the question I had. Are the medications given out through the MHOs, and is it able to, are they able to cover the needs of the people within your reach?
Chair and Representative, the psychotropic medications right now are paid directly by the state. So they would be dispensed by the pharmacy. The pharmacy would send the bill to the Office of Mental Health, Office of Medicaid Assistance Programs.
And are we covering most of the patients in need?
There is no formulary right now for those classes of medications or any financial restriction in the amount of them. Is that not quite right, Representative?
Well, are we talking about people who would qualify for the Oregon Health Plan?
We are now, yes. I apologize for not making that distinction.
And we're reducing the number of people that can qualify for the Oregon Health Plan.
That is very true.
That would be Oregon Health Plan.
Standard is decreasing.
Standard, and that's the one we've dropped from 100,000 to 20,000, or we will drop it.
You're right. We were over 100,000, and we're on our way to 24.
Yeah, but Representative Anderson.
I guess my question was, you're talking about these five, six organizations, number of people coming in, some covered by the Oregon Health Plan, some not. Is there access through the MHOs for instance, the psychotropics for those folks that need it in the MHOs that aren't covered by the Oregon Health Plan?
That's the question.
No, there is not. That's
so I guess the logical next question might be, Linda was able to access this assistance immediately, irrespective of any sort of qualifying or any eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan. Who pays for the drugs and ongoing drugs in that emergent type situation?
Yeah.
There's somebody out there, back there? Okay, go ahead.
Representative Dalto, I can speak for myself alone on that particular issue. My medications at that time were prescribed by Dr. Fredrickson of Marion County Mental Health, but they were paid for and are being paid for by the Army because my husband was a retired military serviceman, so I get all of my medications free from the Army.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to excuse this panel and ask Gina also to come up. And is it you, Gina? Yeah. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. It was delightful.
Gina Furman, you had a perspective on this question.
Yes, Chair Dalto, committee members. Medication management is a little bit complicated because of the cuts in funding. As you mentioned, if you're OHP eligible, you do have access to medications right now, although, as Representative Greenlick pointed out, if you're standard eligible, we're moving from 100,000 to about 24,000. If you're not OHP eligible and you're what we call the working poor, there is limited access to medications. We do get some monies from the state for that. Also, communities band together and find creative ways to fund medication, but that really is a problem. and the state and OMAS and counties are actually working on that. And we have a work group taking a look at how we can better manage medications. But that is a problem with the working force.
Representative Anderson, did that clear it up for you?
Yes, but could I follow up with another question?
Please.
And that is, the pharmaceuticals have a number of plans. Do those cover any of the psychotropic drugs? You know, Pfizer and Novartis and people. Do they help in this area?
Chair Dalto, Representative Anderson, when this all came about, there are several pharmaceutical companies that have plans to help out the working poor.
Future plans, or are they present
plans? No, current plans. I must say, and this is my opinion only, so I'm going to state it as opinion. I personally have talked to several people, and I don't know of one person that's actually been able to access that. Others may know. I'm going to turn around and look at Mr. Nichol or anybody else. That has been my experience, is that the pharmaceutical companies have stepped forward and wanted to help. Maybe Frank can add. However, the consumers that I have talked to have been having trouble accessing.
Chair Dalto, Representative Anderson, I think it's something that works on a community-by-community basis. Mm-hmm. I know when I worked in Deschutes and I worked in Lynn, quite frankly, we worked the drug reps for samples and then recycle those, obviously based on expiration dates. The scholarship programs with the drug companies, I think, are helpful, but it also depends on how good the case manager or the therapist is at walking a person through the process. And I think the other compounding issue is that given the means testing or the criteria for some of the drug companies, I mean, some of our clients, you know, while they may be able to afford to live and have an apartment or whatever, they still have an income that's above what might qualify them. And then the other compounding issue is that there's no coordinated effort between the drug companies. Each company has their own forms and their own process to go through to be able to access those medications.
It appears to me that that is coalescing, that they're getting together and offering more as one or two or three cards, a lot of different medications. And I think it must be said, too, that not all companies produce psychotropic drugs. One small company may have a lock on one drug that's very helpful, but they don't make money on other drugs to be able to give out everything on the drug that they do produce. But I think we're going to see, at least until the federal government steps in more, I think we're going to see the pharmaceutical companies trying to help as much as they can. As a retired dentist, I know how it is to work a detail man for some medication. And, they can only go so far, but they do help.
Chair Dalton, Representative Anderson, I would agree. I think we are beginning to see them to step up to the plate. And quite frankly, in some areas, in Albany, as a matter of fact, we are fortunate to have a woman who is the head of the pharmacy at Fred Meyer, who has definitely gone the extra mile to be able to help with that. And I think there are some companies, one that comes to mind, Eli Lilly, has clearly taken a very close look and has been very supportive of mental health services in the state.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
I just wanted to comment on that, too, for Representative Anderson's sake. I had some experience when I was legislative assistant to Representative Hobson, and just in the Seaside area, that my personal physician actually hired one person to manage the paperwork required to do it, and you had to keep applying each month. And I had one constituent call me when this man, who was 75 years old, he called me on his birthday, and it was taking up his entire day to drive to town, to round up a ride, to get to town, and bring his roommate, who he explained was in her 70s, but they were just friends, and let me know that was their day's activity to do this. And they got to the clinic, and they had to wait in line because the nurse helping them handle the paperwork, by the time they got finished, it was over after 3 o'clock, and they started at 9 in the morning. And it's about a half-hour ride. They live past me. And one way. And so my point being, I was just amazed that they had it. And he says, yes, and we have to do it again. We have to make another appointment in 3 weeks to get in. And so we sent him flowers for his birthday and told him, you know, get. But the reason they were all living together, these people, because they were having to pay so much. The help was there, but it wasn't enough, and it took so much time. And it's like their whole existence was spent rounding up this help for the prescriptions that were just eating them out of house and home.
Frank, can I ask you to state your name again for the record?
Frank Moore.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay, thanks, guys. We'll move on to our last panel, which is a panel from the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, Kay Anderson, Mike Lebichek, is that right? Lebichek, thank you. And Malin Olson. And we'll try to go about 20 to 30 minutes on this panel, and hopefully we can finish before 11. Welcome, thanks, good morning.
Good morning. Greetings, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. My name is Katie Anderson, and I work on the Extended Care Management Unit, which is a clinical team within the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services that was started in 1994 with the downsizing of Damage State Hospital, with the intention of taking some of those funds, or a lot of those funds, and putting them out into the community in terms of developing projects for people and being able to get them out of the hospital into the community to improve the quality of their life. And I think overall, on a global scale, that has really worked well. Of course, there are dilemmas along the way, but I think it's worked really well. Our unit, just in terms of giving you an overview of what we do, we gatekeep the state hospital. So when people who are in the community end up needing acute services for psychiatric illness, they maybe go on a hold into acute care, or you know, some other way of getting there. And if they become civilly committed and they get usual and customary care in the acute care unit, and there's an assessment that they need longer-term hospitalization, then a request comes to our team. And one of the people on our team gatekeeps. The state hospital basically reviews packets, says yay or nay. There's an appeal process. But we basically look at, does this person need to be in the state hospital? Is there evidence that they need a longer-term state hospital stay instead of getting them back out into the community? So if the person gets on the state hospital transfer list, they'll stay in acute care, and I'm sure that you've heard at times about the transfer list to the state hospital and how that's, it can be a very large list in terms of folks sitting in acute care waiting for a state hospital bed to open up, which is one of the things that we try to balance and try to sort out as we go. Our goal as a team is to review folks on that list and to try and divert people to a less restrictive setting. People at times stay on the list long enough that they don't need to be in the state hospital. And we look at the counties that they come from and say, you know, this is a person that you've served actively, you know what their issues are, they really don't need to be in the hospital. What can you put together to get them back out so that we don't have to have them go to the state hospital, which can be traumatic for folks? And it really, in some cases, it just doesn't help them. It makes them worse. If they need to be in the state hospital, that's great. But if they don't, let's see if we can divert them. The other thing that we have currently are two programs in the state, one in Portland and Gresham and one in Lane County, that are diversion programs that serve folks for 30, 60, or 90 days. So one of the things that our team does is looks at folks that we feel like we could divert from the state hospital when they're still in acute care, and see if we could have them go to one of those programs if they're agreeable to do that, and be able to get treatment and transition back into the community from there and avoid either staying in a high-priced acute care bed or going to the state hospital. So that's one of the things that we work with. We also gatekeep community programs that were, when we first started in 1994 with some of the funds from Damish, it created these programs in the community. And right now, in terms of our team, we gatekeep just under 700 beds in the community throughout the state of Oregon. I happen to cover Eastern Oregon right now, and we're doing a fair amount of development out there, which is, I think, a welcome thing. But it also can be somewhat of a dilemma in terms of where people may want to live, or being able to encourage them to go out to Burns or someplace far east. But we gatekeep those beds in terms of looking at people going into them from the state hospital, as well as working with the program, working with the consumer in terms of what they want to do as their goal in life, transitioning from those programs. program, so it's not an end-all. It's a transitional program. We're adding 100 beds by June of this year. And really, those 100 beds are being targeted for folks who have really specific special needs. For instance, they may have sex offender issues. They may have brain trauma. They may have issues that keep them stuck in the state hospital because the existing resources we have aren't a match for them. We also do utilization review on an ongoing basis in terms of working with programs. We work with the state hospital campuses, both Portland, Salem, and Eastern. And again, we're dealing with civil commitments, so not forensic, but civil commitment. And looking at what do people need, where do they want to get to, how do we get them there, and how do we keep them moving through the system. Otherwise, the system, as we all know, gets log-jammed and doesn't work very well. I have one comment just to add to the last panel in terms of the whole issue with medications. One of the issues with the cuts in the state of Oregon is that folks who get SSD benefits only fall into this medically needy category. And in terms of me trying to transition people on or our team, one of the dilemmas we run into is that when someone leaves a structured residential program, they may lose their eligibility for medications, which then bumps us the way of the pharmacy and pharmaceutical company and trying to get scholarships, which I think they've been really receptive to do. The last I heard is every 3 months that we're needing to reapply. But I think the concern we have is that going to be an open-ended thing that happens? Is that always going to be available to people? So we want to support transition and people moving on, but are the pharmaceutical companies ongoing going to be able to provide that if something doesn't shift in our system in terms of being able to provide coverage? In terms of how state hospital patients move into the community, on the three campuses, in terms of people who are civilly committed.
I've been sitting here thinking about the term gatekeep, and sometimes language defines reality. And I wonder if it's a different reality when you describe your function as keeping the gate, guarding people to make sure they don't get through that portal, from, say, customer service coordinator. Whether that different view of what your job was at that gate, it could be defined differently by the phrases that you use to sort of characterize what you do. Are you so overwhelmed that your job is really to stand out there with your musket and at that gate and make sure nobody passes into the state hospital?
Representative Greenlick, our job is to make sure that people who clinically need state hospital level of care get in, and people who don't, we try to divert and support community placements. I think
I think of a different verb to describe what it is you do.
I think that people in the community and in the state at times feel like we are the gatekeepers and, oh my goodness, we get a denial on this person. Why would that be? So I think that we're sort of the rock in the hard place in a way in terms of gatekeeping. But I think when I think of gatekeeper, and I don't know if that is the best word for us, I think in terms of the community end and when we get people out of the state hospital, we also are pushing the gate open. We are trying to basically move programs, move providers, move consumers to look at less restrictive alternatives and look at what their goals are and how do we get them there. So we do a lot of mediating, moderating, trying to work with all the systems.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. In terms of the...
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Katie, just to step back before you move on, when you were talking about the diversion programs, one in Portland and Lane County, and you said 30, 60, 90 days, are those beds?
They are beds.
Okay, so you have, and that's one facility in the Portland area and then one in Lane. How many beds are in each of those?
We have 16 in the Portland area, and I believe we have 6 in Lane.
Okay.
Right now.
And so with the beds, that's kind of like an inpatient status. So your diversion, then, do you have any outpatient services within that category?
Part of what those programs do is they work with outpatient. So their goal is to actively transition the person from that step-down program, the 30, 60, 90 days, and get them back out into the community.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair. Representative Butler.
If I may, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry that I didn't jump in there and get my question earlier with the rest of my colleagues. But I'm anxious to know, Kay, in the process of working
in the regional organizations, these MHO, mental health organizations that we have throughout the state. Is this common in other states? Do other states have their regional associations and affiliations? And I'd like just your comment, where you're working in Eastern Oregon, obviously with my Gobi friends and associates, and have the association with other of these MHOs. Is this a good way to go? Should we as a legislature attempt to foster and enthrone this as the next great devolution of state government back to the people?
That's a really big question. Representative Butler, my experience with MHOs has been a mix, to be honest, in terms of just the balancing out of what people, you know, it comes down to, in many ways, dollars and how people are managing those and how we provide best service, best practice to people in those regions. I do think that MHOs have been really interested in doing creative work around alternatives to people being in acute care, ending up in the state hospital. So I think that as long as people are coordinating and communicating together and working together, it can be a positive layer in the system.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I'll probably ask that same question of Madeline when it gets her turn, because I'm really anxious. I see this as a really good thing. I'm really anxious to see what we can do as a legislative body to perhaps enthrone, to take the best that local governments have been able to do in coordinating and putting together these kinds of affiliations and partnerships, and then to say, okay, you know, here's a really good one over here, and here's a really good, what's the best of each of these, and then can we codify that as part of the state, as part of what we do at the state level, to say, okay, now let's figure out a funding source, a permanent funding source that belongs to you folks. And then let's cut you loose and let you do something. And maybe the only thing that the state would be at that point would be a resource to local governments, to the local consortiums and mental health organizations, and then maybe assist with obtaining the goals that you set for yourself. So that if you've got a duty to, if you've got a maintenance level of services, to make sure that you're arriving, and then to act as a vouchsafe program back to the federal to say, feds, they're doing their job, there's no reason why they shouldn't qualify for a two-for-one match.
Mm-hmm.
Or we'll stand behind the audit of this particular mental health organization. We'll stand behind the audit of that they are doing what they say that they're doing with the federal funds. The state will be we'll use our long arm to say, we'll support you as long as you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. Again, I'm going to direct that same question to Madeline.
Chair Dalton, members of the committee, I'll just finish up quickly. I know we're time limited. In terms of people transitioning from the state hospital, there is a system within the hospital on all three campuses where people are determined ready to place. And this is in coordination with the treatment team and with the client. And basically then the clock starts in terms of looking at how do people get transitioned back out into the community. And there's a number of pieces of the process that I won't go into, but our team is a piece of that, either from the beginning of it or once someone's been referred out and it's been difficult to find them a place to be or to find them services that they need in the community. So one of the things our team does is really work with the state hospital around specific cases, people who really need specialized services. We make recommendations to our office about what those services look like. Part of that new development are some of those services for people who've been stuck in the state hospital. A lot of people go out into existing community resources that our unit, Extended Care Management Unit, is not necessarily involved in liaisoning with, gatekeeping, for lack of a better word. But a number of folks do who end up in the state hospital system these days. And so we work with both providers, community mental health programs, treatment teams, social workers, and the client in terms of what their goals are, what their interest is, and where they want to be. And basically get them there and then work once they're in the community at looking at where could they go from there, reviewing this all as transitional. It's amazing how people who are really struggling with symptoms can make incredible moves in their level of independence and what they do in their lives, and yet, you know, be out there and having a life, which is great.
Just a little analogy to, as an addendum to what Tom just said, and I don't know what you think about it, but just having worked with, I'm a firefighter in a small volunteer fire department, and we have experienced a change in our dispatching activities from locally dispatched to, once you get within our district over a certain line, if a call goes in a cell phone, it goes to Salem. The local call may be dispatched out of Salem. And Highway 26 is one of our main arterials we work on. Highway 26 goes from Seaside all the way to the east border.
Over by Tom?
Yeah. And let me tell you how, when people call in an accident or something, or they're in their car upside down and they happen to find their cell phone and are conscious and alert enough to make a call, they don't know where the hell they are. And all they can say is, we're somewhere past Saddle Mountain, or if they even remember seeing that. A lot of those calls come from people from out of the district, or people who are even from Portland and don't know exactly where they are. So my point being that sometimes local is best. In our area, when we're dispatched locally, they actually recognize our voices on the radio and the phone. And they know the streets, they know the area, and it saves time. And I just think that sometimes we, in our small town areas, and this is rah-rah for rural Oregon, know our areas better than somebody in a big metropolitan area.
Thank you.
That's why they don't let legislators have cell phones. We don't know where the hell we're at. We'd be calling somebody trying to have them get us out.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Greenlee.
I really would like to comment on that, and I really strongly favor local control, but what I worry about, since the state block grant is really so small, a very unusual small number, that we might devolve the government into giving the responsibility back to the local areas and not give them any money to go with it. What that movement towards local autonomy might turn out to be is one more unfunded mandate. We need to be really cautious about how
their own source, own resources. Was divested and belonged to them.
Yeah, but we need to make sure there are resources. That's the point.
Representative Jensen?
No, I don't want to weigh in on that particular issue.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Katie. Thank you. Mike?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike Lebachek. I work with in the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I coordinate the activities of a large federal grant known as the Real Choice Systems Change Grant. It's a three-year grant with funding of about $2 million, and the charge is to change the system. An easy task, huh? To change the system, the way that the grant is written is a bottom-up approach to systems change, to provide people who receive services more ability to advocate for themselves, to speak for the types of changes that they want, to be more involved as stakeholders in having a voice in the way that the system operates. That's one way. Another way is by improving access to housing that's affordable. We have a grant that goes out to all, went out to all of the counties. That can be an individual person who has a barrier to housing can access a small mini grant to get starting in housing. We've seen 377 people improve their housing situations through these grants. We have a pilot project that's taking from the developmental disability side of systems delivery, a method that's called the brokerage delivery system. And in mental health, we're the only mental health brokerage that's consumer run in the country. This is funded by the Real Choice Systems Change Grant in Multnomah County. Through this brokerage, people have individual accounts with which they may purchase their own selected supports and resources and services. 25 people are receiving those services. 4 were employed at onset. Currently, 9 are employed, and that's 8 months into service delivery. There is also over 100% increase in persons receiving employment. The idea is that when people are able to direct their own care, to have more choices in the care and treatment that they receive, their self-esteem improves, their vision of hope improves, and they're with that self-reliance naturally follows and self-determination. I know this in my own life. I was told by people working within the mental health system years ago, that I would never work, that I would never be able to go off of medications, that I would be in the system the rest of my life on Social Security. I proved all of those things to be wrong.
You're still in the system.
I'm still in the system, in a different part of the system. I am working, I think. And I've seen in my own life that people can and do recover from mental illnesses. People who've been given diagnoses that seem to be a life sentence of being in the system as a recipient can move out of that to lead full and productive lives. The President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health reported in their vision statement that we envision a future when all people who are diagnosed with a mental illness can and will recover. And the activities of the Real Choice Systems Change Grant, by lending self-direction to the individuals who receive care, are demonstrating that this happens in steps, and our system of care as it is making a migratory change towards having more consumer choice, more consumer stakeholder input, more honoring of the directions and goals that the individuals themselves want. And with that, I think we're seeing a system of care that lends itself to people recovering, people being less reliant on systems, system services, and system dollars, and taking on more meaningful roles in the community. I'm very honored to be a part of this effort. It's a lifelong dream, and I'm very grateful to be able to tell you about it today.
I appreciate it, Mike. Thanks. Madeline.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Madeline Olson. I'm the Assistant Administrator for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And my role here this morning is to talk to you about some changes that are occurring in the children's mental health system. I think, as you heard earlier, there is a system there, and it is changing and has changed some for the better. It has been something that was very helpful to Ms. Taylor, as you heard her life story. But often in the system now, we still have it in clusters that are separate. They're managed separately, they're contracted separately, and they're paid separately. So, for example, you heard about the mental health organizations this morning. They have responsibility for acute care and what the system thinks of as outpatient care. But the services that families may need if their child has quite a severe illness are separate from the mental health organizations, and the families have to find their way either from the county if they're not on Medicaid or from the mental health organization somehow to these other pieces of the system. So the big change that we're looking for is one that's centered on improving the quality and the seamlessness of services for children and their families. It's a system that will bring all of the disparate parts together so that if the family has a need, they'll go either to their local mental health authority in their county if they don't have Medicaid, or to their mental health organization. They will then receive the assistance to have that need met. One of the things that will change, I believe, is that instead of the system principals meeting separately from the child and family and determining what's in their best interest, the first conversation will be, how may we help you? The conversation that Linda had when she came to Salem the first time. The families know what they need and what will help them. This new system will have all of the tools instead of only part of the tools they need to deliver that help. Now, it's going to make a lot of changes. There will be changes for the mental health organizations and for the counties because they'll begin to have a set of responsibilities that they haven't had before, and that's to manage the psychiatric day treatment part of the system and the psychiatric residential part of the system. The more expensive and very scarce resources, but the resources that are absolutely critical at certain points in these illnesses. They have concerns about that. Will they have way more responsibility than they have resources to meet? The providers that are currently in the system and providing these services are working very, very hard within the structure that they have, and they're doing excellent work. But when they're finished with their work, they are more or less, depending on individual communities, connected with the next part of the system. In the worst case, the family's left with, well, now you've had a year and a half of psychiatric day treatment, and here's a referral, good luck. That's not what we want to see. Under this new structure, there'll be a care coordinator for these families with children with very high intensive needs. There'll be a rational, systematic way of determining which children have access to these scarce resources. In some communities, it's because you were lucky enough to get there when a space was open. In other communities, you go on a wait list. And in the life of a child, months on a wait list is just something we don't want to have happen, because you lose opportunities. They lose developmental opportunities as they continue to be ill, and they can't participate in the normal developmental processes for children. So there'll be a system that's controlled locally, it's managed locally, it will be consumer and family driven. There'll be local governance structures for the quality, for the access, and for the service delivery system problems that come up that will be by and large driven by families and consumers. So it'll be those local governance structures, the regional governance structures, and the state governance structures will be 51% families. That's very different. It puts, if you bring one family member into a committee of 20 bureaucrats and expect that they're going to be strong enough or comfortable enough or even have enough time in their life to understand all of the bureaucratic language to make a difference, it's an unfair place to put them. When you have 51% and you have a structure to support them, train them, provide the technical assistance in being effective in driving systems, we'll see changes we haven't dreamed of, I believe. So that's the big picture of what's happening. If you're a provider right now in this high-end part of the system, you're very concerned. You know how to do business the way it's been done. You know what the contingencies are, you know what your responsibilities are going to be, you know who you have relationships with. We're asking this set of providers, and many of them are involved and have been for months now, creating a brand new set of relationships in their communities with the schools, with the local mental health folks, with family organizations, with child welfare. Some of them have had these relationships, others have had some of these relationships. They'll be looking to a different way of doing business, where they'll be part of a system of quality that looks at not only how long children stay, but what is the kind of treatment they're getting. Are they getting treatment that is really the state of the art, the treatment that science tells us is going to work? Is family therapy offered at 2 in the afternoon for families that then have to take unpaid time from work, or is it offered in the evening, maybe with a potluck dinner or something, so that it's a welcoming environment that speaks to families? Maybe it's done on Saturdays. But each community will have that opportunity to decide that. Out of this, you'll see treatment plans that aren't developed by professionals, but are developed in concert, in partnership, and you heard Mary McBride talk about this earlier, with the family, with the child. Those treatment plans will look at the family's strengths and hear from the family what it is they need. Oftentimes, in my experience with some earlier projects, what families needed weren't $200 a day placements in a residential setting. They needed somebody to help in transition periods in their home for a few, really relatively few dollars a day. You could help that family over the transition of getting ready to school or coming back from school and transitioning back into the family life. That is an incredible bargain financially. It kept that family stable and intact and helped them feel strong and secure in their ability to parent their child. This is what we're looking for. Is it going to be easy? No, because our office has to change, the provider network has to change, mental health organizations have to change, the counties have to change, and change is complicated and it's hard. But we know from the things we've read, the things we've seen, the stories we've heard like Tammy's, that these kinds of systems will do a much better job of meeting the needs for our children and our families. And it's really the child and family version of what Mike was talking about. It's where you, instead of prepare people for a life of dependency on the system, you ask them what they need to have their life, to form their relationships with their friends, their peers, their faith communities, so that they have normal lives. When you talk to adults with major mental illnesses, they don't tell you, what I want to do is be dependent for the rest of my life. They want to have friends. They want to be able to work. And they want to have a place to live that's decent. With this system, we can stabilize children and give them the resources they need to be prepared to be adults in our community and to give back to the community. And with that, I could answer questions or I could give you more detail.
Well, I'm amazed. I'm sitting here thinking, first of all, this is an exciting time to be in children's mental health, I think.
It is.
What you're describing, this sort of sea change in the way you're approaching dealing with these kids, it's hard to imagine sitting here that we're just now getting to this kind of place in how we approach the system. I mean, it's a revolution that you're describing, but, you know, why did we wait to 2005 to get there?
Well, Chair Delta, that brings up something I probably should have said and didn't. I'll say two things. One, I was involved in another role in the late 80s and early 90s in a project that sought to do this, but in such a limited way and with limited foundation funding that it really couldn't change the nature of the entire system. I think frustration on behalf of parents and advocates for parents brought us here, and the driver that is very helpful in this was the budget note that was placed on our community mental health budget by the 2003 legislature, which set out a set of principles and a set of activities that had to occur and a very clear timeline by when they had to occur. And that, after a little while, got everybody to the table saying, we're going to do this. We're going to make it work.
President Butler.
Thank you. Madam, I just need to, you've talked about an integrated system of care. Excuse me, for those people that you're called to serve. My angst is whether or not you see the regional mental health organizations playing a part in that. Are they part of the delivery of the services that you're talking about? And how do you see that? Is it a seamless transition to be able to get this these levels of service out from the state through the regional organizations back to the local delivery centers where the people are really getting the opportunity to help people?
Chair Delta, Representative Butler. For the children who are Medicaid eligible and on the Oregon Health Plan, the regional mental health organizations are the vehicle for knitting all of this together. For children who don't have Medicaid, then it will be their local community mental health programs, and the same kinds of standards will be available. Because we're so heavily dependent on Medicaid in the system, there are a lot of odd things that occur. With this new structure, what will happen, instead of a family having to figure that out, like, okay, if I can ask the right person, somebody's going to tell me that if my child needs to go to the children's farm home and I can't afford to pay, once they're admitted to the children's farm home for an odd set of federal reasons, Medicaid will pay for that. Now there will be a care coordinator at the local level that says, you know, Ms. Olson, we understand what you're trying to do with your child. We've done everything we can to support your child in his home, but we really think in everybody's interest a couple of, 30, 60 days at the Christie School would be most helpful. And I'm saying, but my insurance won't pay for it. I don't have any money. I've got a second mortgage on my house. They will say to me, you don't have to worry about that, because once your child's there, the federal Medicaid program and the Oregon Health Plan will pick it up, and then we will be there working with that program and bring your child back to the community, and your supports that you've had will still be here for you.
Mr. Chair, what I'm hearing you say, Madeline, is that the state works well with the MHOs now, and ultimately the local mental health programs who either rely upon their relationship with a mental health, the regional mental health organization, or the state, there will still be a seamless delivery program.
Chair Dalton, Representative Butler, there will be, but it won't happen, you know, on July 1st or even October 1st. It's going to take a while to knit that together, and probably in the kids' mental health system, about of the total money available, about 90% of it is Medicaid. So we have a less of an ability to help those children and families who aren't on Medicaid.
Well, what an engaging presentation. You've piqued the interest of the entire panel. Representative Anderson, then Representative Greenlick, and then Representative Jensen, and we have to shut this down. Cool host.
Boone's
out of luck.
Well, I guess I'd second what you said. I thought we started out our session here a couple weeks ago with some very interesting presentations, but it's getting better every day. And I want to thank each one of you, all of you, for the presentations you've made. I'm excited by the creativity that I'm hearing this morning. I've often thought, you know, in Josephine County we have traffic court from 8 to 5. It means that people have to take off work. They can't get there. A lot of them skip it, and as a result get in more trouble with the law. And my feeling is, hey, if they live in Cave Junction 30 miles away, have your court in Cave Junction. If they can't get off work, then have somebody scheduled to work from 2 till 10 in the evening instead of from 8 to 5. And what I'm hearing from you is you're starting to think about the client, the consumer, and that's excellent. The more we can do that, the better. The other thing I guess I'm very proud of in Josephine County, we've got a consortium of 30 churches that are bringing people from every faith, well, most of all from the Christian faith, but anybody that has a need, on Thursday nights, they come in, and there's a whole team of people, 100 people, that are there to talk to them, to listen to them, to start talking about their problem. How can we help you? What can we do? This isn't just one body or another. It's 30 different groups that are saying, we're all together. We are here to serve you. And I think the more we can engender that throughout every community in the state, takes a lot of the load off you and puts it on the back of the community. And that's the kind of creative thinking that I think we need to get to, that we can't fund everything, so we might as well get people locally helping in their own local problems. But I congratulate you on what you're doing.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you. I'm intrigued with the continuation of the discussion that we had in the interim on this issue, and I've been impressed as a relatively new member of the legislature with the power of a budget note. Now if I can just figure out how one gets one. In the discussions on this change in the interim, I heard a lot of family advocates say, my kid needed really intensive services, and I couldn't get on a list. I was on a list, and I couldn't get really intensive services for that kid. So we need a more integrated system. Take the money away from intensive services and put it into an integrated system, and then my kids will have more access for intensive services. My concern at that time was, I too think we need a continuum. I think we need the integrated model. You need, but I was very worried that the resources that provide the relatively few beds for intensive services, both in mental health and really in substance abuse, where there's almost none for adolescents, whether this integration that was essentially moving money specifically dedicated to intensive service for adolescents into the integrated pool is likely or will diminish the access to intensive services when those are the things that are really needed. Do you have a feeling on that? I still feel uneasy about it.
Chair Dalton, Representative Greenlick, changing the service model won't entirely fix the problem of short resources. But if pieces of the system are standalone and not knitted together, people stay in them much longer than clinically they need to. So if you have a bed and it's so isolated that people stay in it a year even though maybe at 100 days they could have gone back to the community with supports, you can only serve one person in a year. But you could serve three people in a year if there were the community supports. So that's part of what bringing and knitting systems together does. I think if some of the providers that are facility and bed-based are some of the strongest advocates for this change, because they see the potential really as nonprofit entrepreneurs for using their expertise in a much broader way and maybe being able to follow some of their children much longer into the community and lend their expertise to rural areas where you're never going to have enough need to place a large program, say, in Harney County. But with expertise in Harney County and some supported foster homes with treatment available, you could, instead of sending Harney County children maybe to Pendleton or to Portland, you could safely and properly serve them in Harney County. That's business for the provider that does that outreach, and it's the right service for the community. This won't happen overnight. It's going to take a lot of conversations, and it's going to take the families in the local communities keeping up that pressure. But it's really about communities saying it's the right thing to do. Our children should be our children, and they should stay in our community. And so we'll band together to do everything we can within the resources available, but they can't make new money, and that won't happen.
Thank you, Madeline. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenlake. Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Just a comment to start with on Representative Greenlake's point about the power of a budget note. I appreciate what he's saying. I think, however, we need to understand, Representative, that the power of the budget note may be at least to some significant degree effective by the willingness and desire on the part of the agency to respond to that.
Absolutely.
Sort of thing. I would
best budget note would be one that helps people do what they wanted to.
I would love it if our budget note always had this much authority, and I do compliment the Occidental Health Services to, you know, but that wasn't where my questions were. I really had two questions. One early, Madeline, in your testimony, I probably should have stopped it there to ask this question or to identify this issue, but Mr. Chair, we've had a lot of discussion about in here and with other groups that have been before us, and we'll probably hear a lot more about individuals as they interact with, as you were putting it, 1 to 20 bureaucrats or 1 to 20 professionals, whether that's bureaucrats or semi-bureaucrats, not always sure. How many bureaucrats do you have to have before you inhibit one person coming in? Is it 10? Would 10 inhibit them?
Chair Delta, Representative Jensen, I think it depends on the circumstances, probably depends on the nature of the bureaucrats, and it greatly depends on the nature of the individual. I've worked with consumers in the adult arena and family members who wouldn't have been inhibited by 100 bureaucrats or 200 bureaucrats. But generally speaking, if you have been at the mercy of a system and you're brought into a room full of people who run that system and then expected to speak up, it's a terrifying environment. So by going to 51%, there's safety in numbers, safety in shared experience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's a point that we need to be aware of when we deal with not just mental health services here, but other human services, because everybody seems to have some place people can go to take their issues or grievances or, you know, whatever it happens to be. And I think we need to be very responsive to the fact that it is an intimidating. And I agree there are some people that aren't intimidated, by whoever, but that's the exception, I think, rather than the rule. And I'm not sure always agents. And I'm I know I'm wasting our time, you know, with that, but it is something that concerns me a lot when agencies hold up this thing that we've got this review panel here that the people can come in front of. And the review panel are the people who have all the power and all the authority and all the money, and the person coming to present their case is not in a very strong position emotionally, I guess, often. And I don't know what the magic number might or might not be, and I didn't mean to, you know. The other thing, though, that I had some concern with in relationship to Representative Butler's question, I don't understand the difference between the Medicaid, non-Medicaid issue where we're talking about the MHO, you know, getting the Medicaid folks right up front, children, and the county mental health clinic getting the non-Medicaid. I mean, explain to me why, what this is. I'm not clear on it.
Chair Dalton, Representative Jensen. We can think about it in two ways. The question I was answering for Representative Butler had to do with the funding and the contracting streams. So for Medicaid people on the Oregon Health Plan, the money flows through the mental health organizations. But as you heard from Jim Russell's conversation, ultimately, the treatment still happens in the local community mental health program and the local nonprofits and some private practitioners. For people who aren't Medicaid, there's a different stream for the money. It comes from the state directly through the local mental health program. So that's really where the knitting together will occur, is in the county mental health programs. And the MHOs, and in Eastern Oregon, there's been a regional structure for many, many years, Eastern Oregon Human Services Consortium. That's where resources that couldn't happen in one community of maybe, you know, 50,000 people or 25,000 or 5,000 people can happen in a region when you bring the population and the resource base together, so that you can have something like the Eastern Oregon Adolescent Multi-Treatment Center, which Umatilla County alone couldn't support, but the region certainly can. So that's, the streams come back together where the people are, at the local counties.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. You do bring up a point of some interest to me, though, in the multi-treatment center. And when we get to third-party pay sort of thing, the fact that third-party pay have so much difficulty getting people into the multi-treatment center, because of the fact that insurance, most insurance, at least in the state of Oregon, will not or does not have a contract or will not have a contract with the multi-treatment center. And somewhere along the line, in the course of the next couple of months, I'd like to, with whoever it's appropriate in the agency, visit with you. Not here, but you know, maybe something needs to come here. But I'd like to visit about that issue.
Be happy to.
Thanks, Representative Jensen. And there is no wasted time in human services, so anything that you're able to bring up, I think, contributes to the discourse. Yes, Representative Boone, a brief.
I finally get my last word. No, and so I just wanted to clarify that. So if you're not in the Medicaid system, and but you're considered the so-called working poor or whatever, you don't have insurance maybe, but you don't qualify for that, so you'd still get treatment then.
Chair Delta, Representative Boone, to the extent there are resources available in the local county, and as I said, they're not sufficient for the need.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I want to thank my colleagues for sticking it out. This was a great presentation. We went a little long, but like I said, I don't think there's ever any wasted time. We learned a lot. Just really energized by this last panel. Thank you all very much. Great job. Thanks, everybody, for being here today and sticking it out. Thanks to Bob Nicholson and Gina Furman.
Sure. You know, if I can ask for one thing for the future, it would be very useful if we had a simple chart that showed the difference between the block grant funding for mental health services, local funding, and Medicaid. I think it would be very interesting for us to see the relative.
Colleagues, next Friday we're going to take a field trip to a local dental office here, and it'll be posted on your agenda. It'll be just 45 minutes or so. Give kids a smile day, where they're providing low-income dental services to kids who are uninsured. So we'll queue up and meet outside on the steps at about 9-ish. We'll try to leave as close to 9 as possible. We'll have transportation to...
a lab coat?
Yeah, Gordy, if you'd like to do some more.
Bring a handpiece.
All right. Well, that should be a fun trip, and with that, we're adjourned.
Good job.